Hello.
Hello,
Hi. Thank you so much for
hello.
meeting with me today.
So welcome again. So are we what go right now or what is the
I'm always confusing people with this. I always just go straight into
okay.
it. Maybe I need to,
No.
Oh, it can be anything. It can be anything. I just turn up and see what happens. It's fine. Anything.
So good to see you, Mintia.
It's so good to see you too.
We'll be using the audio mostly, isn't it?
Yeah, only the audio. Even though I like your whole scene there, it looks great. What normally happens is I just turn up and I don't have like a list of questions or anything like that because I'm just not that type of person. So I'm just kind of coming and I know the essence of, really, I'm not even sure about this, but I suppose the essence is just like it's an exploration. And the idea is that I would like, I suppose, for people who listen to these conversations that they maybe become a little bit more clear in their being, maybe. And also, I kind of have the idea that people who listen to this, they're already familiar with the
Yes.
truth of who they are. So it's not like that we're trying to show them
Familiar
who
with
they are or
the
something. Huh?
truth of who they are.
Yeah, that's just the words that I like to use. Are like they're kind of in there, they know the truth of who they are. Yeah, that's the words that I like to, the way I like to express it. You can say it a different way if you want. Yeah, so usually I don't actually have an idea of what to ask somebody or something, but something did come before I met you. So I know that you talk a lot about openness, you know, like that's one of your pointings. And I know I'm not in satsang with you a lot these days, but I do kind of dip in every now and again, and what I hear it a lot is that one of, or how I see it is that one of your main teachings at the moment or pointings is like to be open and empty. And then I was talking to somebody a good while ago now that's in the Sangha. She was saying, yeah, like Ananta says, be open and empty. And I said, yeah. And she said, and it feels really good. And I said, yeah. And I said, and like, what does that mean for you? And she's like, I have no idea. I don't know. She didn't have a clue what it meant, but at least it made her feel good. So that was something. But really, she didn't know what it meant. So then I also mentioned to somebody that I was doing this podcast with you, and I said that this idea came about to maybe clarify what do you mean, like on a more kind of practical way, so people can kind of understand what it means. And he said, yeah, that would be really good because from this was his perspective. He said, yeah, like how can I be open and empty when I'm like busy at work? Like, so then I kind of felt like, well, it's not really a state. I don't feel like Ananda is pointing to like a state of kind of feeling open and like blissful and joyful. I said, like, my understanding of it, like openness means you're literally open to everything and anything that comes. So that means you're open to, you know, you're open to being busy at work if that's what's happening. But yeah, if you'd like to say something about it, or maybe like if you're able to give any like examples of how you see it in your own life, that would be good.
Thank you for that question. I think that I use it in two ways, so the confusion is somewhat understandable. You see, so the word open, I use it in two different ways. The first way in which I use it is to say that, okay, if you are convinced that you are an object in this world, if you're convinced that you are just a body mind in this whole vast universe, you see, and you're not open to anything, hearing anything about that. That everything will come only from that perspective. Then you're not open enough for satsang, the kind of satsang that we have. Like if you're fully clear that that is your reality, and then you're just trying to make that one feel better or become better or enlightened or whatever idea you may have about what needs to happen in satsang, then that is not openness for me. So we're talking about the first way in which I use the word open.
Yeah,
But
so
if it
can I
is,
just interrupt for a second? So I normally wouldn't like interrupt like that, but just in
no.
this kind of conversation, I will. So just to clarify, like what I hear when you're saying that is really to not hold on to any idea.
Yeah, no, but this specific idea, no? Because you will be in for a big shock if you come to satsang holding on very deeply to this idea that you are just a collection of food or a collection of blood and flesh and bones, and you are clear that that is your reality, and anything that tries to point you to look beyond even a little bit from that notion of what you are, that seems like an attack on you very deeply. And all you really wanted is to get something for this particular body mind entity, then for me that is not enough openness. Of course, many come like that. It's not a strict that you can't come to satsang if you're so like that, but it's just a pointer to get you to look beyond, you know, to look beyond a little bit from the notion of what you take yourself to be. So the what I'm offering to you is the other way around, which is that what you really are is that in which this entire play appears, this entire universal realm of perceptions and sensations and all of these things. You are that in which all of this appears. So it's a very, very big difference. It's a sort of a quantum leap between the two perspectives. The first being that I'm just a tiny object sitting on top of this huge earth, which actually is just another tiny object in this entire universe. And the other perspective is that you are that, in the words of Ashtavakra, the boundless ocean in which these universes come and go. So if there's a sliver of openness to switching out of that perspective that I am just a body mind, if there's even a little bit of space there, then that much openness is enough for me to work with. Because otherwise what's going to happen is that you may not like at all what you're hearing when you come here. So that is the first way in which I use the word open. The second term which I use very often, you're right, that seems to be one of the central things that come out of this mouth, is the phrase open and empty. And we are talking about open and empty in the sense of open means allowing it to come. You see, it's like a non-resistance. Just a simple allowing. And mostly the allowing is at the level of at the conceptual level, where you're not resisting anything from coming, you see, but also at the perceptual level, where everything is allowed to come. So open means to let everything come. Empty means that you don't interfere with its nature, which is to go. So empty means that it's nature itself. Nothing in perception comes and stays. Its nature is to come and go. So allow yourself to not be attached and desirous of whatever may be coming, and to be open to it going. So open and empty means basically the simple example of keep your front door and back door open and allow all thoughts to come and go, all perceptions to come and go. That is open and empty. And it's, I feel like, the simplest thing that I'm saying.
I also feel like it's very simple, but I also understand that people get very, like when they're in satsang, it's very easy to understand, you know, because you're in an environment and it's very supportive. But I feel like the exploration that, I don't know, I guess it's just to like get rid of like ideas that we pick up, you know, so it's like then people have this, or like we can have this kind of idea, but what about like in a practical situation? You know, because I feel like even when you come to satsang and you recognize that the truth of what you're saying, that really we are beyond everything, but then it's like it doesn't make all of our kind of conditioning, I suppose, it doesn't make that necessarily disappear, and the particular stories that make us identified. So it could be that, yeah, when I'm in satsang, I'm not identified at all. And if you ask me, is there any problem? I'd be like, no, nothing. Everything is God. It's beautiful. Like, I feel like many people are like that, you know, but then we, you know, life continues and we find ourselves in a situation, like, you know, we might have a repetitive thing. I think many people do. And then somehow it's like how to apply that idea, or how to, you know, bring that openness and emptiness when you're in the middle of being identified. So I don't know, I feel like it can be very good, I don't know if it's possible or if anything comes to your mind, to kind of share a practical story of how it would look, you know, like when you're like totally, let's say you're in the middle of like an argument with somebody,
yeah,
or something like that, or I don't know what, because I think we can pick up this idea that if there's a challenge in life, or yeah, if there's a something playing out, that then therefore we're not open and empty.
Yeah.
And of course that isn't what it means, because that's life continues the same way. But I think it would be great to be able to dispel that idea deeper somehow.
So there's so much to unpack in what you said. So we can zero in on some of these and see what answer comes. And if the answer is not answering the question, then we can look again and see what is happening. So one of the categories which often comes up, like a mental category, which often comes up in satsang, and you know that many, many of you have asked me this question, that all this is fine when we're in satsang, when we are here, everything seems so easy and peaceful. Mm. But what about the practical world? Or what about sometimes they even say the real world, which is the opposite of what we are trying to say in satsang. But I understand where they could be coming from, you see. So this idea of open and empty, or just this non-resistance, acceptance, is only applicable in spiritual situations. But what about life situations? When I'm fighting with my partner, when I'm arguing with my boss about something, then how can I apply this? So this kind of thing is there. Now, one example is that all of the sages, you see, are speaking a lot of words, and their expressions seem quite different from each other. You see, and they're talking, but they're proposing this state of non-resistance, this emptiness, this openness. You see, so who speaks these words? Like, is the speaking of words a practical activity, or is it a spiritual activity? The speaking of words in itself is neither. It could be in, like, our mind could make categories out of them and say, hey, now he's speaking spiritually. Or now he's speaking in terms of money or relationships or health of the body. So he's speaking practically. But in the process of the speaking of the words, the body doesn't know that, okay, now he's going to speak spiritually, so just speak from open and empty. Or now he's going to argue with his boss, so now this is the practical, so speak in another way. So there is a certain intelligence which allows the functioning of everything in this universe, including the movement of this body, you see, from that space of pure intelligence. So our idea that we have to involve our conceptual version of reality, our conceptual idea of what is true, that is the mind, in those conversations which mentally we have categorized to be practical, you see, that is not true. Actually, a simpler way to put what all I've just said is to refer to Master Bankai's words, which is that all things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. You see? So what is the unborn he's talking about? It is the same unborn. It is the same open and empty. It is the unborn mind. So in the no mind, all things are perfectly resolved. Now, he did not categorize and say, no, only things about self-realization or self-knowledge or enlightenment or spiritual. He said, all things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. Now, actually, those things about self-knowledge and realization, there is no problem there. So that could not have meant needing resolution in the first place. You see? So he was basically giving us an antidote against this kind of doubt and fear which the mind produces. He says, okay, but what about my problems? What about my quote-unquote real life? My practical life? You see, so he's given us a guarantee saying that all things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. And you know, the thing is that nobody who's going to listen to this has to believe me or take my word for it, because then you're doing the opposite of what I'm saying. This is just pointing to experiment with this. You see? Experiment with being open and empty. You see? Being open and empty in all situations throughout life. And see if you become vegetative, or action doesn't happen, or, you know, things don't happen.
Mm.
Yeah. So open and empty is a possibility, no matter how your mind categorizes your life situation. You see, it's completely possible to dip into the intelligence which is beating our heart at this moment and running this entire universe with so many billions of processes. You see, the same intelligence can also have an argument with our partner and negotiate salary with the boss.
So can I interrupt you for a moment?
Please.
So what you're saying is really, or this is how it gets like filtered through here. And this is actually how I'm seeing somehow lately on a much deeper level, yeah. Is that really nothing needs to be resolved, because this is the idea we have. This is exactly what you said. I'm just saying it in a different way, but like literally nothing needs to be resolved. So we have this idea that when there's a kind of a challenge, like, so for example, okay, I have this thing that comes up in my story that's like, I kind of want to be healthy, you know, so I want my body to be healthy. And it's based on like the foods I eat and all. So like sometimes I'm eating healthy foods and sometimes I'm eating unhealthy foods. And like, it almost seems like when I'm eating healthy foods, that's good. And that's like in alignment or something, you know, but like I say, like, it's all the same thing. Like, so whether I'm eating unhealthy foods or eating healthy foods, or like there's a kind of a sense that you need to, you know, this idea can come like, oh yeah, but I just want to have a balance, like, and it's like, it's a, it kind of like, it's a story, I suppose, that can, like, there's identity because I get so kind of involved in it a way. But like, I'm just kind of saying, like, really, I don't need to resolve it at all. So it can stay exactly the way it is. And maybe it will, you know, it's just like, it's just a little loop that's going on over here. You know, so there's this loop, and then maybe there's another loop, another story, you know, so it can be forever that, like, sometimes I'm eating healthy, sometimes I'm eating unhealthy. And even that struggle, you know, if there's like a little kind of a struggle, like, oh, I don't feel good when I'm not healthy, and oh, I feel great when I'm like eating well, and I'll, oh yeah, I feel like so good, and I'll, like, it's like, it's literally, I can just totally leave that alone, because it's got nothing to do with, like Master Bankai says, the unborn. Because I feel like somehow even that idea, everything is perfectly resolved in the unborn, you know, we can have that idea then, but like, but I'm not connected to the unborn or something. But of course, we don't even need to be connected, like the unborn is just here. So it's just like, just leave everything as it is. Like, everything is perfect as it is, or unperfect, or everything just is as it is. Like, we don't need to
be. Only it's very brave with what you said. The only thing I would add is that sometimes in hearing something like that, it is possible to create some sort of a level confusion.
Mm-hmm.
See? So when Master Bhakta is saying Danbon, or from here we are saying open and empty, we are talking about your inner space, and we are using the word provisionally. Mm-hmm. There's no actual space like that, but just for communication, we say we're talking about the inner space. So inwardly open and empty, and outwardly all activity could be very frantic also sometimes. You see, it may seem like you're fighting against the whole universe. You see? Like some sages have been very missionary and very activist. And it seems like they've picked up fights with great kings and rulers and everything. So it may seem to the external observer that they are not feeling everything is perfect. You see, they are not letting everything be as it is. This is not acceptance. This seems to be pure resistance to what is. So from the inward space of openness and emptiness, outwardly, the activities are allowed to flow as they will. And we are not to judge our own openness and emptiness or another openness and emptiness based on these activities which may be happening from the outside. So that is the first thing. So that is, thank you for pointing that out, because that often gets confused. You see, but Ananta, you're supposed to be open and empty. How could you go to work and have meetings about negotiations with clients and things like that? You see, that's not possible. You should just go to clients and say, whatever you offer, sir, you know, is, we will do the work for you, like that. But that's not, that could emerge from here. There is openness about that. But also it could emerge that, hey, you're not being fair. You see? So it is not about judging what is coming out of the mouth or how the hands and feet are moving. It is more about the inner space of openness, acceptance, non-resistance. That's why you'll also see that some expressions like Maharaj seem to be so strong when people were coming to satsang with them, and people may say, but you seem actually very angry right now. You see? You're talking about this peace and openness and things. You seem actually very angry. You see, so the external expression should not be confused with the inner state. So that is That is the first thing. The second thing that happens is that we feel like without the mind, we have a complete loss of intelligence. You see? So the things that are needed in so-called life are not going to be possible if we let the mind alone. And therefore, we just have to accept that everything is perfect and just sit like a sadhu in a cave, you see, not participating in any sort of way with the rest of the world. Mm. But that's really not true. See, there's an intuitive guide, there's an intuitive intelligence, which is actually, so if you talk about the body, for example, right? So suppose you had to pick between one of the two, your ideas and notions of what is healthy, unhealthy, what is the right eating, what is the wrong eating, you see, or the intelligence which is running the millions of processes, which is running your body at this moment, fighting infection, beating your heart, making your breath function. Every single part of the body has millions of things which are going on. Apparently, I don't know these things, but they do. So it seems like there's a very deep intelligence which is able to juggle all of this stuff, right? So if that intelligence is available to us as a guide, which we call intuitive guidance or intuitive insight, then we would we not rely on that rather than our notions of what is healthy or not healthy, which if they are in sync with the way the world goes, changes every 2-3 years. Mm. Same thing, which is super unhealthy is healthy now and super healthy is unhealthy now. Mm. Did I say the same thing twice? It's possible.
And can I ask you something? Like, would you say that that openness extends, like, so when you were talking about openness, really it was just about, I don't mean just about because it's the most fundamental thing, but like it was about the idea of who we are, but like would you extend it, yeah, so like we're really feeling it more, like to extend it into everything, you know, so to not hold on to really strongly like ideas about what is a healthy body, you know, because you're not, even though let's say if you leave that idea aside about who am I, you know, okay, for a second, and then if you're just dealing with like one particular story, because I feel like that's how most of us live in a way, is from like story to story to story, and we want to kind of have a lived experience of the truth that you're talking about, so like to not hold on to even the story at all, like you can, so even if you were taking yourself, let's say, to be a person, like a separate individual, even if you were taking yourself to be separate, then to let go of the idea that I, as a separate individual, know what's right for my body. Even to let go of that is an openness as well.
Yes, I would say that. And that is the beauty of intuition, that not only is it the source of insight about who we are, what is the self, we can only recognize that intuitively, but also the source of guidance for the so-called worldly functioning or practicality. Mm. You see, intuition seems to be the best guide for that. Mm. And it's the best sportsman, the best scientist, the greatest artist, all of them have also said the same thing. That they tried and tried and tried, but when they actually let go, then it just came to them. You see, the best composers of songs have said the same thing. That, oh, they tried to compose, but this most beautiful symphony, it just came to them. Mm. So when they are saying came to them, they're really talking about this intuitive intelligence. And when they say they tried, they're talking about trying with the mind or trying to figure it out in the head. Mm. So in all spheres of worldly activity, you see, this intuitive guidance is available to us. And it can never really let us down, you see. Except when we are too strongly attached to the idea of what outcomes we want. So if we burden this intuitive intelligence with a mental idea of what is good and bad, then it may seem like intuition let us down. You see, what is that judgment based on? You see, it is based on a concept of what should be the right way to go or what is the better way. But over time, when we look back, and again speaking in a worldly way, when we look back, we are able to look back at things and say, okay, I'm quite grateful to this, how it turned out, because it has got me to this point today.
Yeah. And that, like, I don't know, this is just what's going on. That, like, unbornness that you're talking about are like open and empty. So, in a way, you're using the words open and empty for the self, basically. You're not saying like be open and empty, like you're actually saying, you're just using the words open and empty for your true self or your unborn. Or
maybe I can expand on that a little bit. So I'm saying that that when we are open and empty, the self is apparent to us. What we are is truly apparent to us. Mm. So I could say, for example, that, and to anybody who ever listened to this, I could say that as you are open and empty this moment, isn't it apparent to you that you are beyond the content of your perceptions? It's naturally apparent to you. If you don't try to squeeze this knowledge into your mind, you will notice that it is so clear, if I use the word heart, in your heart, that you are not just the content of your perceptions at this moment, and you are beyond that. And some of you may say that it is apparent to me that primarily I am that witnessing or awareness, which is aware of the movement of all of these perceptions. Without any heavy lifting or hard work to do, just as we are open and empty, this apparency is always available in our hearts, in our intuitive insight, not an emotional heart, but in our intuitive insight. So open and empty is to see, to have an insight about that which is the self. The self itself is always really speaking, always open and empty. But we are talking about the self manifesting as consciousness, and within consciousness playing the game of individualization. And what is the advice given to that aspect of consciousness? To remain open and empty so that the truth of what they are becomes clear and apparent that very instant.
I like something that I heard you saying recently, and it was something along the lines of, like, you don't have to be concerned with anything that's basically coming up in your life at all. Like you said, I will take care of that, or like the self takes care of that, but you said I will take care of that. And all you need to be concerned about is self-recognition. And I feel like that's very beautiful. And I actually feel that's like enough. So everything that you're saying, and obviously you're my teacher, so I'm obviously going to like agree. And I do feel like, and I see, like, you know, let's say I've been with you for, let's say, 6, 7, 8 years. And like I can see over and over again, like when I just take your teaching, so which means like to just recognize that, really being open and empty and recognizing that the truth of what's just here, I feel like that's enough. And it actually kind of the word that's here is like it kind of deepens somehow, and it somehow does like leak into the rest of your life, you know, like it, if you have like a story over here, like you start to notice on a deeper level that it's okay to just leave the story, it's okay. But I do have this conversation quite a lot because, you know, I'm with my fiance, so I won't say his name on this, but you know who he is. And like we kind of have a different way of thinking about things. And I feel like we talk about these kind of things a lot and obviously share what's going on, you know, with each other. But he's kind of representative of like a different way of thinking in a way. And I feel like he and many people, like we can kind of feel like to just go to self-recognition all the time is somehow not enough. You know, it's not enough. Like it's almost like in the middle of being identified, we need something else. And I do understand it as well, because sometimes when we're feeling really identified or something, it can feel like we can't access that space that you're talking about. We're not able to access that openness and emptiness. Now, of course, if we're really dedicated to a teacher or a teaching, I think you can just like let go also of the idea and that feeling of struggle that I can't connect to or something, and to just kind of let the essence of the teaching in those difficult moments is probably enough. But I don't know, something wants to, it's not like an argument, like this is the right way and that's the wrong way, you know, because everyone has different ways. But I don't know what it is, like something wants to, I don't know, it's like just bring the two together and let them be together, like those two ideas that you need to look at individual things as they arise. Because what I think, and my argument, because I'm kind of arguing on your side, I feel, if there's an argument, it's like I feel like openness includes absolutely everything. So it's not that your teaching is pointing only to, it is like it's pointing to self-recognition, okay, like to just recognize who you truly are, but I feel like that's so inclusive that like if something comes up, you know, like I don't know what, like some kind of challenge or identification or something, there's room in openness, because openness means that you're open to everything. There's openness to looking in it whatever different way, or playing with different things, you know, like to explore psychologically if you want to let yourself feel everything, to even to, you know, all the different spiritual practices, basically, you know, like whatever occurs to you, there's openness there to include that. Like, why not? You can include it if it occurs to you. Because, yeah, so it's, I just feel like that teaching of recognizing who you are, it's not, you don't have to always go straight to that. I don't know if you wanted to, if I'm even making sense, or if you wanted to say something.
Okay. So a couple of things I want to say about this, and remind me if I say one and forget that I had another one. Mm-hmm. So the first is that this invitation that many masters make, which is to say, let everything in your life become my problem. Let everything become my problem. And then if you have to be concerned, that is a corollary. If you feel like you need at least one problem to solve. Mm-hmm. You see, then say, okay, solve the problem of recognizing who you are or realizing the self. Mm-hmm. You see, otherwise even that extended instruction is not needed. Let everything be my problem, and that could include be the problem of self-realization or recognizing who you are as well. But sometimes we feel like we struggle too much without at least one thing that is ours to fix or resolve or something. So I would say, okay, you fix the problem of who you are, discover who you are, but everything else I will take care of. Mm-hmm. Now that invitation is not coming from Ananta. It's not coming from this man. It's not coming from this guy who's sitting here. This one is just, this body mind is just an instrument for whom that invitation is coming from. And actually what we discussed so far in the conversation about being open and empty, it is just another way of saying that. You see, it's exactly another way of saying that, because some of you may have a devotional sort of temperament who could resonate with that. Sometimes open and empty seems too empty. You see, there's no flavor of love and devotion in that. So those with a devotional temperament may resonate with something like this, that I trust my master, everything is the master's problem. You see, so what happens then when we do that? The mind is the seller of concerns and the seller of problems. When we say master's problem, Sadhguru's problem, you see, Guruji's problem, what happens? Then we remain open and empty. So it is coming back to the open and emptiness through another way of expression. See? Now, why do I give that particular appendix or extension to this instruction? Because suppose you were a kangaroo and you spent your whole life solving giraffe problems. You see? And then in your death bed, somebody tells you, no, actually you're a kangaroo. You see? Won't you be very upset that I spent the whole life solving giraffe problems? In the same way, if we just presume to know who we are, you see, and we run around solving the problems like we talked about in practical life, then at the end, or maybe not even the end of this life, we realize that, hey, I was not the giraffe at all. I was a kangaroo. You see, so wouldn't it be helpful to the kangaroo who's solving giraffe problems for him to hear or her to hear from someone, are you really a giraffe? Mm. I mean, okay, you spend 50% of your time or 80% of your time, 90% of your time still solving the giraffe problem. Mm. But isn't it worthwhile to spend that 10% mm. just exploring whether the giraffeness is your reality? Mm. You see, because you don't want to figure this out 10 lifetimes later. Do you? Mm. If this is true that you're not a giraffe and you're a kangaroo, mm. somebody better come and tell you now. You see? So that is really the invitation to self-realization. It's just a question, but who are you? Before we can figure out what to resolve, mm. is it important to know from which perspective? You see? Mm. So if you thought you are grass and actually you're a cow, or if you thought you're a cow and you're actually grass, mm. you see, you could be solving the opposite problem. If you are grass, then you need to find a way to get the cow to go away. You see? Yeah. And if you're thinking you're a cow, then you're actually inviting the cow to eat you up. Yeah. So when we take ourselves to be this person that we imagine ourselves to be, then isn't it worthwhile when somebody comes and asks you, okay, you have all these problems that you're solving, all these things that you're trying to fix in your life and the world, but isn't it worthwhile to really discover whether these problems really apply to you or not? Mm-hmm. You see, so that is the invitation to self-discovery or self-realization. That is where that part comes in. What is the second part of, oh, I knew this is going to happen. So what was the second part of what you were saying?
I was saying something like, just to kind of somehow, I was saying that within recognizing that you're actually not a kangaroo or whatever you're saying. Yeah. So, that there is also space to deal with individual things, because I think what happens within a mind is like, but that's too dismissive, you know, like, so many people think that non-dual teachings are very dismissive. Even non-dual teachers think other non-dual teachers are very dismissive. And many people think your teaching and Muji's teaching is very dismissive. And I understand why they can think that, but I don't feel like it's true. So that's why I feel like something in me wants to kind of clarify or bring out that it's actually not true, and really in that point, and that there's really is room to also look at a problem, you know. So even though you're saying you don't have to, if you're not really a kangaroo, like, you don't have to solve kangaroo problems, but yet we are experiencing ourselves as a human. So even though we're not just a body, we're not a body really at all. so this body is appearing and we're experiencing, you know, it's our experience. So, you know, that teaching can sometimes lead to, okay, that's not my problem. So people kind of neglect their lives, and people do it. I'm sure you've heard of it many times, but I feel like that's not the whole thing. Like, the whole thing is that really when you take that point in and you're really living from there, that whatever problem is arising, you'll really look at it, maybe you're looking from love, I suppose. And it's not like you're thinking how, like the way you're saying, like, it will be more intuitive, like, and maybe sometimes it feels like you don't know what to do, you know, like there can be challenge in your life or something, and it's like it feels a bit like, I really don't know what to do here. But maybe there's not that sense that I need to do it, but still, it doesn't mean that you're going to completely neglect it, because things need to be solved, like, in life also.
So thank you for asking that, because that is a common misconception and it's a subtle point. So let me see if I can just sort of demystify this whole notion of Advaita denial. You know, many non-duality teachers, or those who are pointing in some way, are accused of this Advaita denial. Yeah. So what is this Advaita denial? And I agree that it is completely possible. You could be in satsang with me and you could come become a Advaita sort of denial sort of individual in your play as consciousness. So that is why I keep emphasizing these days that what I'm pointing to is not that. So how would you do that? Suppose you had to become like that, somebody who does Advaita denial, how would you do that? So what you would do is an idea comes, or your partner comes and says something, or somebody in the world comes and says something, so that concept appears to you, then you have a spiritual concept or an Advaita concept that you heard from Ananta, and you use that concept as a defense against this which you're hearing. You see, as a defense, or even in the worst case scenario, as an attack, you see, on the concept that you're hearing. So Advaita denial, and it is possible in all teachings actually, but especially in Advaita, because they're so final sounding, you see, that this kind of denial and actually defense and attacking can be very much inherent in the mental play of the spiritual seeker. So what happens is your wife comes to you and says, and this actually happened with me before I met Guruji, you know, the story that Garima would come from a tough day at work and she would say, oh, this one was so mean to me today and I had such a hard time, you know, at work. And I would say to her, but who is the you that had the hard time? So that is a sort of Advaita defense or Advaita attack. You see, that I know better and I'm going to show you what that better is. So what is the difference between what is being shown here versus that kind of interplay, right? So open and empty, you see, or non-resistance or staying in the unborn is not to get involved in the fight about concepts anyway. You see, so someone comes and says, yeah, 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 DDD, boom, 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 ta, ta, ta. Like, it could intuitively, silence could emerge from here. You see, or other blah 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 could come from here. You see, but to not get attached and take your position to be the one that has to be true, because ultimately it's all nonsense. It's just words. You see, so to take words to really have the ability to point to reality is the mistake that many times spiritual seekers make, especially in the path of Advaita. You see, so they feel like they've got some mastery over the master's words. So then they can use that to fix everybody else around them, and they feel like they got the solutions now to fix themselves or some nonsensical adventure like that. You see, so in this way, Advaita denial can definitely happen. So even it happened in satsang, where I could say, why don't we look together and inquire into this? But somebody could say, but didn't you say 5 minutes ago that I am not the doer? So that is the kind of conceptual battle which is possible in the head when it comes to any sort of pointing, but especially with Advaita. Now, on the flip side, you see, what is being proposed here, or the invitation in some sense that is given to everyone, is to meet everything openly, meet everything fully, you see, which is the opposite of denial. Just fully what appears. You see, what is the way to deny? You see, what is the way to deny? I'll tell you one way to deny which is most popular in the world. Suppose somebody is coming towards you and you start labeling them. Oh, this guy is an American. You know, this guy is wearing shorts and a baseball cap. You know, this one. So by the time this one has come to you, you already have a mental image of what that one is. You see? And therefore, that is a defense against what he really is. See? So you made a picture and your responses are coming to that picture. He could have just said hello and you were like, oh, okay, hi, you know. You see? So not that you have anything against Americans in baseball caps, but I'm just using that as a example. Right? So this is the way to deny, to label and to pretend that you know something conceptually about what is appearing. You see, is to deny the meeting fully. As opposed to, this one is walking towards you. You don't have any preconceived notions. You're not labeling. You're remaining open and empty. And that is when the true meeting can happen. You see, the true meeting could still have the same outward outcomes. You see, I'm not talking about the outward outcomes. It could still have the same outer outcomes. But inwardly, you've remained open and you're not actually denying. So funnily, it is Advaita, which is pointing very directly to not denying through use of labels, not defending through our conceptual understanding, and meeting whatever appears fully. You see? But it can be used in that way when it just becomes a conceptual Advaita, when it just becomes a learned Advaita.
Yeah. I think, like, just the tiny little difference in words gives a totally different feeling here. Like, so if you say like be open and empty, or if you say meet everything openly and something, like they feel totally different, because in, I feel like, or I really like hearing that, like when you're saying meet everything openly, that's real inclusive. Whereas I feel like to say be open and empty, it's almost like it can stimulate the idea of like being in a particular state. Whereas meeting everything openly, I know it's the same really, but somehow it's like you're already in the state, then you don't have to do something. Like,
exactly. So that's true. What you say is true, in the sense that that is why when you come to satsang, you don't just hear be open and empty, be open and empty.
Yeah.
Same thing is given in 10,000 different ways, because everybody carries a different set of perspectives about every word, right? So what they connect the word to differs for everyone they meet. Like God is a very important example of that. So everybody has a different perspective about God. So sometimes I speak about God, sometimes I don't speak about God. Is it because everybody carries a different baggage around the term itself? You see, and what that translates into. You see, so when I say, for example, if I say, for example, just make sure you meet everything openly, for some it may feel like, oh, but this is a very specific instruction to a body. You see, to another it may seem like, oh, this is very helpful because I'm not forced to become something or be something that I'm already that. You know, so why should I be given that kind of instruction? So that is why that in the words also of satsang, the same pointing, you see, because there's no perfect way to point. It is pointed in thousands of different ways, and with the hope and intention somewhere that maybe this will hit home, maybe this will hit home in this way.
So can I try to make it like very practical? I don't know if I'll be able to, because I just know the kind of things that people have, as I'm sure you do, but like the kind of idea like that a lot of people talk about these days is, you know, like trauma in the body. And my way of interpreting that is conditioning, but whatever it is, like conditioning trauma, you know, but we can feel like, let's say we feel something really, I'm trying to think of an example in myself even, but let's say something that feels really hurt or something, you know, and like, I don't know really, but there's an actual, a physical feeling there. So then to remember that idea of be open and empty, I guess it kind of ties in with, you know, that we really don't need to do anything, because that's really what creates trouble, isn't it? Is like, let's say we're feeling this pain, we'll just call it pain, okay? If we're feeling this pain, then the idea is that like this is not of God or something, you know, it's not meant to be here, and really I'm not experiencing God if this is here. Whereas like when we take that away, like something you said at the start, that I really don't need to be concerned with the problems of the body, then the openness is that we're just literally just then that feeling of pain is here, and really just I don't need to do anything with it. And that's why you said something at the beginning as well, then it's allowed to go. Because I feel somehow when we kind of get involved in the story, even if you're trying to make it go through, let's say it's like, okay, I'm going to do some breath work now or something, and but you're doing it so that it will go, you know. So it's just, I suppose, letting that idea that we have to do anything with it, and then it will be allowed to go, I guess. Because it kind of pulls me in, you know, that argument that we need to do something about it, because I feel like in my heart I really know and I live like this also, that like we really don't need to do anything. And I feel like the teaching is not enough, but somehow it does pull me in a little bit sometimes, because I don't know why it does really pull me in. But like I feel like, yeah, because there's just the whole idea in the world, you know, of releasing trauma and all, and I think it's totally valid as well, you know. And but really when we don't try to do it, like it's just the natural course of things, like the way when you said I will take care of everything, you know, like, you don't need to take care of anything phenomenal or anything in this world, any stories, I will take care of everything. So in a way, that means to me, like, within ourselves, if we notice trauma arising inside us, but then also simultaneously we recognize that this is not what I am. So it's that inside us that's actually taking care of it, because it's kind of like creating a, well, it's not really, but it's kind of like creating a kind of a space for it to just allow it come and go. So obviously it's not like you and Nanta are taking care of it, or you like some like Satguru over there somewhere. It's like, it's this like space in your own being.
Yes. So this is the thing that this is again very important point you're bringing up, that no matter what the quote is or what the book is or what the pointing is, there is no pointing like that which is universally applicable. Like for many, we could generalize and say, and that's why we let quotes and books be published. It's because some things could quote unquote work, generally speaking, you see. But it actually just boils down to the existing condition. So there could be someone who comes up in satsang or comes up on Zoom and says, oh, but, you know, I have this trauma, I have this pain. But in my heart, if I don't feel like open and empty is the right advice for them, and something else comes, then I'm open to doing that. If I've never done this, but if in my heart some advice comes that you must go to a pranic healer or something, you see, which I haven't done, and it doesn't seem like the natural kind of advice that Amrita gives. But if it happens that way, I'm open to that as well, because I cannot predict in advance what guidance is going to come from here. Yeah. You see? So when we say these are the main pointings or the main kind of tenets of which I'm using, it is because those who come to satsang seem to generally be helped with this. But we cannot universalize and say we'll definitely be helped with this, because it all depends on how it is going to be heard, what is. And by the way, going intuitively does not guarantee that it will be heard well. So that also we have to remember, that to go intuitively, to be true to your heart, you see, also does not guarantee that a particular outcome which your mind is saying should happen happens. But still, you see, there is so much trust in the intuitive guidance that I feel like grace is taking care of that in that way. And then we can be free from the notion of whether I said the right thing or the wrong thing, and is this one really being helped or not helped. So even the unborn, open and empty, all of these pointings, although they could generally speaking be said to be the main pointings, I would not say that they're universally applicable. Yeah. So it's all very moment to moment, depends on which questioner comes up, and what kind of resonance happens and what kind of reaction comes from the heart. That is the first thing. The second point you mentioned also is very good, which is that the tactical approach to spirituality, right? So you're saying that, okay, now you heard that what you resist persists. You see, so I'm not going to resist the ego anymore. I'm going to love it, but I'm going to love it to death. You see? So there's a kind of tactician working over there who's saying, okay, now the ego is that stupid that, you know, I'll just pretend to love it, but all the time keeping an eye out on whether it is gone yet or not. So that creates these sort of dichotomies in us, you see, which then become more troublesome than the original condition. So we cannot outmaneuver the ego. We cannot become a master tactician and say, okay, now I've understood the way the ego works. If I resist it, it is going to persist. You know, Jung or somebody said that. So what is my approach now? I'm going to just love it, man. I'm just going to love it. I'm going to love it so much that it will die. Now, what kind of love is that? Just loving something, waiting for it to die, is not love. So we must not get into these kind of tactical things. And you also took a nice example of that. Sometimes we just get into this kind of game, and it is the ego playing both sides of chess, actually. So we must avoid this kind of thing, because it's not really helpful.
And there's just one last thing that I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if the words will be right, but I wonder if anything will come. So I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I can't remember exactly what they were saying, but they started to say something along the lines of, oh yeah, I read somewhere an enlightened person is like this, this, and this. Okay. And I was listening, and then I said, yeah, but I said, I don't really like that idea of an enlightened person. Maybe it's like the enlightened view is like this, or it behaves like this. So meaning like when you're looking from here, it will maybe behave in certain ways. And I know that's debatable, but the thing that I wondered if you'd be able to say something about is, so you're kind of sitting there and you look like the body of Ananda, you know, but the words aren't really belonging to Ananda, really, you know, the words are just coming out. So there's, let's say there's these kind of set of teachings, and they're maybe encouraging us to live from the enlightened perspective, which is here in all of us. So I kind of feel like, or what I see in myself is that, like, yeah, many like words of wisdom and all can come, you know, and they can, you know, whatever. But then also there's still the life of a body, mind, like, so there's still the life of Amba, and like she has, you know, certain just her certain ways of being and different kind of challenges and all. So it's almost like that body mind of Amba, I know this isn't really accurate, but the body mind of Amba or whatever has to also take those teachings as well. And it's like, oh yeah, like, and maybe sometimes maybe you might forget, or not necessarily even forget, but maybe just sometimes those teachings are reminded, you know, so they're coming from inside or wherever they're coming from, it doesn't really matter. But yeah, so I wonder if you would say something about that, like in the expression of Ananda, if sometimes he's reminded of his own teachings, you could say. But of course, they're not his own teachings because they're not belonging to anybody. Because the reason why I want to, or why I'm asking that, is because I feel like there's such a big, strong idea about someone who's in the position of being a guru or something, that they are somehow different than everybody else, which is obviously not what the teacher is saying. They're saying over and over again, I'm just the same as you. But often the teacher is only sharing wisdom teachings. They're not really sharing practical, we can't see their life, you know, we can't see, okay, they needed to be reminded that, okay, just now is enough, you know. Like, for example, sometimes I might see myself like getting a little bit anxious and stressed because I have, let's say I have like 5 things to do today, just making something up, have 5 things to do. So like I start to feel like a little bit of like anxiety, oh, I have to do these things. But then the reminder just comes, like, just now is enough, or something, or like whatever it is, the reminder that comes. But so that teaching is like, it's almost like just seeping into all the different aspects, yeah, of the body mind. I don't know if that's clear.
Yeah, thank you for that. I feel like, honestly, I should say yes, but I have to say maybe. And I can sense that the right answer sounds like it would be yes. But I just have to say what's coming here now is a maybe. But really, it's more my family and the Sangha which keeps me straight. You know, so I feel like if I'm ever flying around too much, as I'm talking about this one, flying around too much, pretending to be some major guruji or something, my daughter will say, oh, just get me some water from the kitchen while you're coming from there. Or, you know, why are you behaving like this? Why are you acting so smart? Or she just tells me openly, of course, wives don't need an invitation to set you straight. So I'm constantly being set straight in that way. But really looking also, just the other day, I was telling all the Sangha which is here, saying that all expressions, you see, or let's say many expressions, start with great purity, great insight, great awakening experiences, great wisdom, you see. But it is seen also very often, especially in this country, that a lot of these expressions can go wayward. started off with great purity, great openness, great acceptance, and then it starts to feel like, oh, I know best. How dare you speak to me like that? You see? So it goes in that sort of spiritual egotism, the worst form of the idea of the enlightened egotism. You know? So I'm the one that is awakened and enlightened, and all of you are stupid and you better listen to what I have to say. You see? Otherwise, you'll go to hell or something like that. So, and I recognize that potential exists here as well. You see, I feel like everyone should recognize that potential exists here. So that is why, if you remember, and I keep making this deal with everyone, that if you ever feel like I'm guiding or driving the Sangha using fear, you see, or using the idea that you may not be worthy, that you may not be good enough, and therefore you need to do something harder, work harder, inquire harder, be devoted more. I don't know what is the way to do any of that, but it's popular to hear about these kind of things, that you are not devoted enough, that's why you're not getting it. See, you're not worthy enough, or you're not inquiring hard enough, that's why you're not getting it. Or just the general demeanor becoming so full of authority that everybody coming becomes so fearful of being around you, and therefore the openness to ask questions, the openness to even say, hey father, can you just explain to me why you're doing it like this? So that kind of fear becomes prevalent, and maybe as time goes along, the one who's been put in the position of the master doesn't also realize that, oh, things are going in this way. Things are going in this way. So that's why I make a deal with most of the ones who come, that if you ever find that something is becoming very overwhelmingly fearful, you see, when we try to approach you, you see, or things you seem to be driving us based on guilt and unworthiness, you see, then please can you explain to me why is it like this in our Sangha? You see, I feel like that is very important to do. The reminders coming question, I really want to say yes. Honestly, I really want to say yes, but I can't.
I don't know
yes.
if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah,
maybe I have to word it a different way. Like, you know, the way, like, so a body is born in the world, like a baby, okay? And they have their upbringing, you know, and it seems like we're all conditioned. You know, so we have, our parents are giving us different ideas, things are good, things are bad. Maybe when we're very young, like certain things make us upset, like maybe your mother threatened to take away love from you, or you know, whatever things, like did this and that. So then when we're older then, and maybe also awake as well, so we're also awake to the truth of who we are, but somehow our bodies still behave as if it's responding from a position of separation, like that's what the reaction seems to be, you know. So maybe when you grew up, your mother maybe kind of said something to you over and over again. So now when you go and visit your mother and have a cup of tea, and she says to you, you know, she says, or maybe, yeah, all the time when you were growing up, this happened. So now you go and you have a cup of tea with her, and she kind of like tells you to wash the dishes or something. I don't know. But something gets like, I can't think of a good example. I'm terrible with examples. But like basically something maybe gets triggered because it's being triggered so many times. You know, it's not a great example because that's a very small thing. But like, I feel like many people, I actually think everybody, so if you, I'll tell you, I find it really hard to believe, like if anybody says there's absolutely nothing, like nothing ever arises, like I would find it really hard to believe you or anything like that. So that's why I'm almost like trying to like pull it out of you that like something like that happens, because as a, also as a kind of a solidarity, like it's human, you know, there's like a human there's a human expression, and I kind of feel like being, now I'm not stuck on this, so you can tell me if I'm like totally wrong, but like I kind of feel that the more we kind of grow, for lack of better words, but let's say the more we grow in God, and the more that spirit is opening up to us, then we're actually kind of just recognizing our humanity. You know, okay, this is the humanity. Like, okay, I feel upset when somebody does this, and like, it's okay, but like, you kind of recognize it, you know, but that it's okay is the teachings, let's say, but it's still there, you know. So it's like we're actually allowing ourselves to be fully human by recognizing the divinity in us. That's not that the humanity completely disappears. Definitely. Because it can sound like that.
Definitely. So, and we've spoken about this over the years many times, that everyone who's come into this play of the human condition continues to be affected by this much. You know, it may be really small, maybe it's really small, but some conditioning, some egotism remains in all who have taken birth, let's call it that. You see, so the greatest masters, the greatest sages, we've taken these examples over the years, that even Jesus, in the worst of circumstances, for a moment said, "Oh Father, have you forsaken me?" You see, before coming back to the recognition that forgive them, for they know not what they do. You see, so it is true. Even God, even in our culture, it is said that Ram is said to have cried when Sita was taken from him. Mm. You see, cried in grief. So of course, this will play. It plays here also. If something says, if someone comes and says, "Oh, this happened to a Sangha member," or "This happened to a child coming from school," you see. So obviously, some grief, some fear is bound to come. You see. Mm. Now, I was just zeroing in on that. That what happens when these stimulus sort of events appear, I just feel like something just naturally returns to openness. Now, I don't know if that's a subtle reminder there, saying return to openness or something, which I don't now recognize as words, but something just goes naturally to natural. You see? So I don't feel like I can place the trigger so strongly now, which is that the teaching or what I'm sharing comes clearly and says, okay, become open and empty, or see what you really are, or are you aware now? You see, I don't feel like in that way so much, just suddenly, maybe even in the process of looking for some guidance, because there is a fear or anger or something arising, in the process of that looking itself, something just very quickly clarifies and reverts to the natural sort of position. Is what I would say usually happens here, although I can't be conclusive about that. So if you ask 10 minutes later, I may say, yes, I'm constantly reminding myself to remain open and empty. But right now, it is this that feels true. So yeah. I have to do
that. No, I understand. It's as well, my questions aren't very clear. That's why sometimes talking is good, I feel, because it clarifies as well. So it's not necessarily, you know, it could come anyway. So I feel also to just say, I just want to say that it's not necessarily better or right or wrong. It doesn't matter what way it comes. So maybe sometimes it comes like, so if it just happens, that's a kind of just, it just happens, you know, you could call it anything, intuitive, or it just naturally happens. But if it comes as like words, like it's not less than, you know, it doesn't really matter how it comes. And maybe for you, like it comes like that, but maybe you'll have some real, I don't want to say this, but maybe you'll have some real big story, like, you know, and then like you get like totally, oh, so like you need words then or something, you know, like we can never know like that. But I suppose the main point was just like that the human aspect is still there, because I feel like sometimes to hear a teacher speaking and you're only seeing them on a computer screen, especially if you spend time with someone, you can see their humanity. But like, I feel like if you're only seeing a teacher on a computer screen and they're only speaking these words of wisdom, we can easily get the idea, like as if they're given the idea. It can sound like they're really given the idea that actually, no, like I'm just purely divine and like I'm in bliss the whole time, you know. But I feel like it's more like just that. I don't know. the words that are coming is like that godly nature or something. It's like it kind of gets infused with the humanity, but humanity is like that, you know, like there is human nature. There is such a thing as human nature, and it's okay to be exactly as it is the point. I'm trying to like, I was trying to get you to say something about it.
I feel like to discover what you really are is not in opposition to any sort of natural human expression.
Yeah.
It is not in opposition to any of that. You see, and all things, all aspects of expression are completely possible. Family expression, work expression, sangha expression, disciple expression.
Mm-hmm.
All those are completely natural and completely possible.
Yeah.
We don't have to determine, for example, like in Zen they say, before enlightenment, chopping wood, fetching water, after enlightenment, chopping wood, fetching water, of course, but or not.
Mm.
You see, it could also be after enlightenment, no chopping wood, no fetching water. Like, who can predict?
Yeah.
So it could be either, and both are welcome, and both are just expressions of the same consciousness. So,
yeah.
It's completely fine. So complete openness is not deciding that this has to be the way it plays out and this should not be the way it plays out. And also what is important in a way to point out is that really it is impossible to be deterministic about anything in the world.
Mm-hmm.
See? Like we must not become deterministic and say, okay, now this is what has to continue to happen, because consciousness is always show us that it has more colors than that. The minute we say this is how it must be, even if we say if you're enlightened, this is how it must be, yeah, or this is how it must not be, consciousness will reveal and say, ah, okay, it can also be that. It can also be that.
Yeah.
More than the mind can categorize, you see, more than our conceptual ability to categorize and put into any conceptual understanding, multifold more are the consciousness's ability to play and consciousness's ability to express itself in forms. So again, I feel like I'm harping on that point, but intuitively there is no problem with any of that. In our heart, there's no problem with any of that. But if we become too categorical and deterministic in our heads about, okay, now that, you know, or that, you see? Mm-hmm. Now, it could be like that, that there could be some, you see, some gray areas over there, mm-hmm. but not on the basis of an external expression or the words which are being heard. It has to be more of the fragrance, you see, more of the smell that you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
That is a more determinant, you see. Now, one of the things that is important for, now this will sound weird, especially to if there's an audience that has not come to satsang, but that's how it's coming. So it is an important part of a master's arsenal, so to speak, is the ability to confuse everyone who's listening to them. See?
Mm.
It's important to be able to confuse. And then what happens is you come into sort of a crazy situation of the mongoose and the snake where both are stuck. Maybe both are equally strong.
Mm.
You see? So it just feels like both are stuck for a bit. So what then happens is you start building an ability to hold opposite ideas with you without them causing you trouble.
Mm.
You are able to hold an idea and the opposite of that, but they don't trouble you anymore.
Mm.
You see? And as they stop troubling you anymore, and then you're losing your need to be deterministic, whether it is left or right, whether it is this or that, whether it is good or bad, whether it is right or wrong. You see, when you lose that nature, that you're not trying to decipher that about everything that you come across, then you just drop into the heart. You see, and what that is just a poetic way of saying that you are not so reliant on your conceptual understanding anymore.
Yeah.
And you drop into that intuitive insight where everything is very moment to moment. What may seem like a grave sin 5 minutes ago may seem like a complete gift or a boon now, you see, based on how the circumstances of the world have changed. So I just want to say to you and all the listeners that it's very important to not have such strong ideas about what is right, what is wrong, and what is what can be confusing. It's very important to also get confused in satsang. Otherwise, if you are coming to satsang and not getting confused, you see, then you're just understanding everything, which could be the worst thing I could do to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you come to satsang and you understand everything, so I'm not taking you deeper than your head. Which is, all this may not be appropriate for a podcast. Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. You see, so it's absolutely all right. You see? 1 minute, left, next minute, right. You see, get fully confused. What's going to happen? Your head is going to get fully confused.
Mm-hmm.
But when you feel like there is love in your heart, when you feel like, you may not even feel like it is love. There are some who come to satsang, you know this, who just say, I didn't want to come because you confused me so much last time. And I came with so much clarity, you see. And now you confused me so much, but I still found myself coming here, you see. So I'm telling you that, all of you, that really, there is no such thing as clarity in the head. Today's conclusions are going to be tomorrow's confusions. I guarantee you that. You see, there is nothing you can say conclusively, deterministically today about the nature of the world or the nature of humanity or the nature of anything at all which you can bet your life on, because tomorrow life will show you the other way.
Yeah.
So, and it is that determinism which is the basis of all suffering, actually. Mm. Because it is that which gets squeezed by life. No matter what the button is, it will get squeezed. Mm. So, actually, consciousness is pressing all the buttons, you see, simultaneously. It only depends on what button you still have, which gets pressed, right? So, and what are these buttons? They're just our ideas of what is true and what we really know about the world, or about this appearance called Maya, whatever you may want to call it. You see? So, sorry if I'm rambling on, but just the last point is that this is the point that the Zen masters really emphasized on. So you can't meet a koan through your understanding.
Mm.
Like, what is the right answer to any Zen koan?
Mm.
Should the goose fly or should it be in the vase? What is the right way to get it out? You see, there are no deterministic answers to these. And yet there is an answer.
Mm.
And yet there is an answer. So freedom is just like that. Freedom is not to be able to determine the right template to life or the right template to all things and say, now I've got the highest understanding. This is like this, this is like that, the world is like this, my partner should be like this, you see, things, my master should be like this. Now I've got it all figured out. And that is my understanding. You see?
Yeah.
You see? And that is just worth throwing the dustbin, actually. Mm-hmm. That is just because that is making new religions. That is making new templates to how to be. But being will show us that it can be in any which way. Now we can resist that, or we can be open to that. So to all the listeners, I'm just, maybe I'm just requesting or pleading.
Mm.
Don't listen to this with an approach that you're going to get some right answers. You see? There's no such thing as the right answer.
Yeah.
It is just something, these words, if they have a feeling at all, it is to deconstruct. It is to deconstruct anything that you may be holding in your head and just allow yourself to meet that deeper intelligence, that higher intelligence.
Mm.
So, I don't know what that rambling or so.
Oh, it's good. That's just for, this is just the last thing I'm going to say. I was saying that to someone recently, like, I think all good spiritual teachings are really, they might seem a bit different, but they're all for the same thing, and the same thing is just to, like, allow us or encourage us to just drop the mind, like, because that's the only thing that needs to happen, if anything needs to happen. So there's many different ways of approaching that, you know, through words or through whatever, but the main point is just that we drop our mind.
I just want to say, I can sense that we are coming to the end of this, and I'm not sure how much time we spend. But I just want to say something which is coming strongly here, and I feel like that really is saving many, many on this path a lot of time. So I felt like it would be worthwhile to share this. If you don't have time, then you can decide whether to edit this out or keep it in or whatever. But I feel like it is important to point this out, that if we are taking ourselves to be spiritual seekers, then obviously our highest discovery that we are wanting to make is the discovery of the self. Now, I've realized, and many have realized, that most find frustration and trouble in the journey of spiritual seeking because they're using the wrong instruments. So what they may feel like, and many may report, that I'm looking for the self, you see, which is right. But if I were to ask them, how will you know that you found the self? Many will say things like, I got this fantastical awakening experience, or an experience of something where I was beyond this universe, I was like the space, or something like that. Or they will say that if I'm constantly in a state of bliss or ananda or something like that, that is when I'll know that I came to the discovery of the self. You see? Now, both of these are not true. In the sense, both of these are still in the realm of perception. And the basis of Advaita Vedanta is that everything that you perceive comes and goes, and therefore is not inherently real. The only reality is that which does not come and go. So if you're waiting for a spiritual experience to be able to conclude for yourself that you have come to the self, you see, and that experience is qualitative, it has attributes, it is about phenomena, then that is not the self. And don't get stuck in some prior spiritual experiences also, which were phenomenal, confusing you and thinking that that was the self. So you can't do it in perception. It is impossible. So stop looking for the self as if it is an object. You see, most of spiritual seeking is trying to seek the self as if it is going to be found objectively as a phenomenal experience. You see, so it is not possible through the instrument of perception. The second idea is that we will come to some conviction, deep conviction about what is true. You see? And that is my freedom. Like, I have to come to a deep conviction. But conviction is just another way of saying belief. You see, like a deeper belief is called a conviction. Mm-hmm. So if I have to believe I am Brahman, and I can believe that I am Brahman truly deeply, and then it is the super concept that I have as opposed to every other concept, mm-hmm. you see, then that is my freedom. One day when I become fully convinced that I am Brahman in that way, conceptually, then that is my overriding concept, then I am fully free. It is not like that. It never works like that. You could say, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman. But when life slaps you, then I am Brahman is the first to go out of your head. You see, first thing that comes is, I am this body mind and I want to punch you back or something like that. You see? So this kind of conceptual understanding does not help us. So our perceptual experiences could help us only in the sense that they remind us of something greater than our present idea of the world. That is the only service. But the self can never be found with your attention and therefore with your perception. Your concepts, no matter how high they may be scriptural, cannot help you come to the discovery of the self. In fact, in the Guru Granth Sahib, it's said very clearly that soche sochna hove jo soche lakwar, which means you may think and think and think 100,000 times, but thinking you cannot come to the self. So really, it is not about conviction. Now, without perception, without relying on perception, and without relying specifically on the perception called thinking or conceptualizing, then what is our discovery? What is the knowledge that we have? So when a question like, are you aware now, is asked, you notice for yourself that you did not need to rely on perception or concept to affirm the reality of your awareness. You see, and it is not the affirmation that is important. It is the recognition that is important. So to be able to discover this without perception and without the need to think, that is self-knowledge. That is intuitive insight. That is the Sadguru intelligence. That is the Sadguru presence, which is the guidance which is being pointed to. So really what I'm saying is that you cannot struggle if you take this pointing to heart, because all the struggle is in the realm of perception and conceptualization. So this is the end of the spiritual journey. If you're really seeking just the self and not the benefits that you could get out of self-discovery, If really it is the self that you want, then don't use the wrong instruments. You come naturally to the right instrument. You see? So to come to the truth is just the letting go of the false, not the creation of a new truth or coming to something which is not already there. It is just the letting go of reliance on the false, that which are pointing to the false identity. And then you will find that your reality is already apparent to you without having to take even the little bit effort, because the instruments of effort we have left behind. So, and the best part is, and that's been kind of the theme of this conversation, I feel like, is that from this, let's call it space, from this space, everything is included. You see? The world's play, the unmanifest nature of your reality, all of that, all intelligence which is available in either aspect is available to you. And that is your own divinity which is guiding you.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that and saying all that.